There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a bird council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, here we go. FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile continues, and yeah, it continues to rain as well. Watching that radar, like Dr. Bill had talked about this morning, and in the updates, rain making its way from southwest to northeast and continuing to soak us pretty much from back towards, it looks like, New Orleans, Pensacola, and more of that to come. So we'll keep our eyes on it. Another update from Dr. Bill at about 1:35. All right, this is a conversation that, if you've listened over the years, we've talked about this before on the show, but it seems to have continued to build and build, and people's attention to this. I hear more about it all the time, so it's good to have this conversation right now about coal ash. And I did say ash, y'all. Coal ash. And what's going on with Berry Steam Plant and the coal ash capping in place, moving it. Casey Calloway and Kate Kistler from Mobile Baykeeper have joined us to talk about it. Y'all, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us, Sean.
Thanks for having us, Sean.
Let's, first of all, let's back up and do a little remedial here for me. So, coal ash is what and why is it where it is and what's the issue with that?
Well, the big picture is back in 1950 or so when we built the Berry Steam Plant, they built it on the side of the Mobile River, and when you burn coal, there's leftover ash. When you burn anything, there's leftover ash. But the ash from coal, of course, is filled with arsenic and mercury and lead and all the nastiest of nasty heavy metals. And all of that gets concentrated, and they kind of wet store it outside of, on a pond, or what was made into a pond right outside of the plant. So over time, over about 75 years, that little pile of coal ash is now almost 22 million tons. It's nearly 600-acre pond, and it's essentially wrapped around by the Mobile River on two sides and then a cooling water channel on one side. So it's pretty exposed. Over time, they finally started to see that that coal ash could be a problem, and there was a big breach in Kingston, Tennessee, on the Tennessee River in 2011. Kate will have to correct me. And or not 2010, and it was a huge mess, almost $3 billion to clean it up, and that really started the nation looking more closely at coal ash and how we close those ponds.
Yeah, there's been, I know we've talked about these big failures that have put coal ash into waterways, like you talked about in Tennessee, but here. The issues are, acute and chronic? I mean, there's a question we've talked about. I've been by, those ponds so many times, been on the Mobile River in my life. But they have a levee around them. And, of course, they're there by the floodplain. But then you've also, I think, talked about this. And I don't know, Casey or Cade, which one you want to take it. There's also a question about getting into groundwater, right? There's like acute, here comes a river flood, it busts open a levee, and then it soaks into the groundwater. Am I close on that?
Got it exactly right, Sean. I think that's the two major issues. One, that you could have a major spill, and that's one that weighs heavily on our minds every hurricane season, every time there's a major flood of the river, and ongoing groundwater pollution that Alabama Power themselves have documented, they've been fined for, and we know that groundwater pollution is continuing into the Mobile River with things like arsenic today.
Do we know how much? Because, I mean, we all go back to, dilution is a solution to pollution. I mean, there's some amount with a volume of water that might not be, you might not be able to pick it up, right? Or is it enough that it's showing up? Can you do water sampling away from there and see it?
Well, Alabama Power's catty response has been there's there's been no sampling that's shown a problem downstream, and that's because there hasn't been really any sampling downstream. They haven't done any to prove there isn't any issue, so they can't show it. But we know that they've violated the limits, I think about 600 times the limit that they're being held to. That's what resulted in that fine. And we know that these things, you know, bioaccumulate throughout the food chain. So when they go out in small levels and the small, you know, bottom feeding animals and bugs eat them, and then fish eat those, and then we end up, you know, roasting some fish over the campfire or whatever else in the Delta, that's when we really start to worry about the impacts to people.
All right, let's talk about this. So we have this coal ash on site there at Berry Steam Plant, and it needs to, y'all's feeling is it needs to go somewhere else. It needs to not be stored there, correct?
Absolutely. The in 2015, they passed what's called the Coal Combustion Residual Rule. They like to make it really technical and really hard, and they did that exactly in 2015. But they said that if you are using any kind of wet storage of that coal ash, that you had to close any wet storage down, period. And if you were in contact with groundwater, you had to dig it up and you had to move it. That the language is being argued as unclear by power companies around the country, and in particular in Alabama. Every other facility, all the other states have decided that digging it up and moving it is a better, smarter option. If you are going to stay in contact with the groundwater, you should move that ash to an upland-lined landfill. Or what Alabama Power is already doing now with the new ash is recycling it into concrete. There is a lot that can be done besides leaving it on the side of a river, hoping we don't have a storm, have a direct hit on a dam that's made of dirt and clay and coal ash.
Yeah, and a lot of questions coming in here, Casey and Cade. This one, can you ask if Alabama Power is trying to cap the coal ash pond in the floodplain because it's cheaper, and what has been the experience of other utilities that have removed the ash from their electric generation plants?
The fast answer is yes, because it's cheaper. But, Cade, will you tell them about North Carolina and what happened over there?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, you know, they've kind of said this is the plan that works, and we can't do removal. It's too time-consuming. It's too expensive. It just can't be done, which doesn't, you know, flesh at all with the reality of there's 250 million tons of coal ash being removed in the southeast. In South Carolina, they've removed all the coal ash in the state voluntarily. Complete removals planned in North Carolina and Virginia. That's over 150 million tons between those two states. And to Casey's point about North Carolina, the leader of the Department of Environmental Quality there said, you know, quote, we rigorously reviewed these proposals, talking about closing the coal ash ponds, and science points us clearly to excavating and removing the coal ash as the only way to deal with this issue.
And we're having a little trouble hearing you, Cade, so if you speak up a little bit there. So,
yeah, absolutely. That in North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, they're removing all the coal ash. And it's something that can be done, and it is being done. And in North Carolina, the head of the Department of Environmental Quality said, the science points us clearly to excavation and removal as the only way to deal with this problem.
Several people asking the same question. And storing it where? Where does the ash get relocated?
Sorry, in some states they've built, the utility has constructed on-site lined landfills, you know, where we are with the river so close and Alabama Power's property. A little bit small there in terms of what they have left to work with. It would need to be off-site, but utilities have constructed their own modern-lined landfills that are spec to deal with this, not some, you know, by-the-side-of-the-road landfill with issues, but a landfill that's built to deal with this issue. There are other landfills out there that are modern and lined and away from rivers, and then one of the most successful ways of dealing with this issue is that it's been recycled into concrete, where it's locked up kind of in a matrix, and these potentially problematic heavy metals are locked up so they can't run off into the rivers or spill. And actually, it's really highly prized for its characteristics for transportation, road projects, that kind of thing in concrete. So that's been done really successfully in Virginia and in North Carolina for literally tens, if not hundreds of millions of tons of coal ash that is happening with. So this isn't some pie in the sky, it's only happening in Europe or somewhere else type solution. It's happening in the southeast of the United States.
All right, coming right back, we're talking more about the ash and the event coming up at the end of this month, too, to get organized here. If this is something that you think needs to change, be done differently, they're going to tell you how to get involved.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you along. And talking coal ash and Barry Steam Plant, Cade Kissler and Casey Calloway from Mobile Baykeeper, our guest. And I want to point out before we go any further, too, that this event, what's coming up at the end of this month? Now, it's is it a hearing or what exactly is happening on March 30th?
On March 30th is the opportunity for the public to tell ADEM, our state agency, our state environmental agency, how we feel about Alabama Power's permit. Alabama Power wants to leave that ash in the ground, in the groundwater, on the side of our river, and just put a cap on top of it. And we think that's the worst idea in the world. If you think it's a bad idea, too, or even if you love it, you should absolutely attend that public hearing. You should get engaged. You should make a phone call. It's really easy. They've got it set up in a good way for the public to engage safely with COVID procedures. But if you go to mobilebaykeeper.org/coalash, you can register to ADEM's site right there. You can get more information right there. You can also write a quick letter to ADEM from right there. It's a good way to get involved, and lots of facts and details for those of you who really want to study it in depth. It's right there, all on the webpage.
So, there's two things going on here. You could get Alabama Power to say they're just going to do it on their own, or ADEM could pull the permit to have it there on site.
Right. We had every hope in the world that Alabama Power was just going to straight up do the right thing. They are a company that we have trusted, that when the power comes on, they're the ones we're praying to see at our front door. They're the ones we're celebrating coming to the front door after a hurricane. Or a major weather event. They're traveling to Texas to take care of people right now. I mean, our Alabama Power workers are really good people who we always love and admire and are grateful for. This is a case that they have made a bad decision for our community, for our environment, for our economy, frankly. And we think they should do a better thing. But if they won't, we got to go to the next step, and that's our state agency. ADEM does not have a great history of being really great environmental advocates or on the side of the people. But we still believe that our battle is a good battle and we are right. So we need to tell our state agency to do the right thing.
All right.
So we need a lot of us to do that.
Well, that's it. And so that's the event on March 30th.
Yes. You can sign up right there from our website.
A lot of text coming in here. Joseph is asking, Casey, if Alabama Power, and I guess Cade as well, if Alabama Power did relocate the coal ash, what are the estimates of cost of its relocation? Would this cost not be passed on to Alabama Power customers?
So that is an excellent question, Joseph. So some of the things, we have asked Alabama Power that question numerous times, and they have yet to share the information with us. However, they increased our cost several years ago to cover the cost of coal ash closure. So we've been paying for it for a while. What we know is that when they did these, Virginia was a state that said, the first thing the state of Virginia said was do a study to determine how much it's going to cost. And what we understand is that they came up to, it would be about 1.0, okay, you're going to have to help me get these numbers right. But Virginia set aside about $5 or $6 per person per month, in addition to cover the cost of 29 million tons of coal ash to be moved from ponds statewide. We think that Alabama Power has already charged us about $450 a month for all of us across the state, and is going to leave it in the ground. So there's a lot we don't know about how much it's going to cost because Alabama Power is not sharing it with us. They've not told us what their analysis of it cost, especially, is of digging it up and moving it versus leaving it in place. We don't think they've studied recycling the coal ash. So if they have, they haven't shared that information with the public. We've asked Alabama Power to get on podiums with us to talk so we can ask and answer their questions in public, and they ask our questions and get them to answer in public. And they won't do it, which is really disappointing. Cade, what have I left out there?
I think you covered it pretty well. I mean, coal ash closure, whether that's closure in place or removal, is going to cost a lot of money. It's already costing Alabama Power customers about $5 a month, and that's going to be about a total of $900 million to close Plant Berry in place. It will cost some additional amount to remove the coal ash, but like Casey mentioned, they're removing about 1.5 times this much coal ash in Virginia, and they're charging their customers about the same increase in rates. So this is something that it's not cheap, but, you know, it's going to be done regardless. So, you know, it's like the old saying, we can get real complex. We can talk some deep numbers, but if you're going to do something, let's do it right. You know, let's not do this thing halfway, spend almost as much money, and then have a catastrophic spill that costs us, you know, it costs $3 billion in Tennessee, and that was a much smaller coal ash spill than what we have here. So there's no reason to spend almost $1 billion to close it, end up with a spill and spend another giant amount and never actually deal with the whole problem.
I want to ask this for a second. I mean, there's the money amount for the spill, but, and I know we need to get to other parts of this, but what happens, like in Tennessee? What happened, those of us that worry about critters out there, fish in a river? I mean, what does coal ash do?
Well,
it kills. It's terrible. Go ahead, Kay.
The Kingston spill, I mean, they had 5 or 6 inches of rain, and they had an earthen dam just like what we have here, and it, you know, eventually collapsed under that rain. And then downstream of there, not only were there huge impacts to the environment, I mean, you can watch some of these videos, and I can definitely send anybody that's curious some, they can email me, of, you know, hundreds if not thousands of dead fish in the Emory and Clinch River, and people downstream who really didn't know when they were going to be able to fish or swim again. There's videos from folks that are watching this alongside the river coming up, and they're going, well, there goes the swimming, you know, I mean, literally that's what's happening. And then you can just imagine these homes that are on the side of these rivers that are impacted by the spill. I mean, literally some of them were pushed off the foundation. That property value is never going to be the same. You know, even if you tell somebody it's all cleaned up, I promise, you know, it's like, I can build a house anywhere. I don't want to live where there's just been this nasty toxic spill.
I think from a visual perspective too, think about it. Think about the last time you built a fireplace or a fire pit somewhere, and you pick up that ash in your hand and how fine it is and how thin it is. And now you put it in water. How do you clean that up? And after we had the BP oil disaster, how long has it taken for folks to trust the seafood along the Gulf Coast? Frankly, I hear stories that people still don't. No, they're wrong, and it's fabulous. But what happens if we have another catastrophic disaster like that for our community? So it's not just the environment. It's not just critters. It's our economy. You would shut down the port from shipping. You would shut down the port from boating, recreation, of course, but also our commercial and recreational fisheries would just be devastated. And there isn't a good way to clean up something that fine and that tiny.
All right. Well, we, once again, before we wrap up, got about 40 seconds here. Remind folks how to get more information, your website, and then what happens on March 30th.
MobileBaykeeper.org/coalash. All the information you could possibly want. Sign up there to speak at the public hearing. We need the community to show up and turn out. You can also send a quick action alert email letter to Adam to tell him how you feel. I say tell your friends at Alabama Power how you feel. Write a note on your power bill. This is something we can do right. As a community, we have to get this right.
There we go. We appreciate y'all coming on today, and probably check in with you again before the end of the month to get an update on this and just remind folks what's happening. So thank you very much, and we'll do it again.
Thanks so much for the opportunity, Sean.
All right. Cade Kistler and Casey Callaway from Mobile Baykeeper, mobilebaykeeper.org/, like they said, coal ash. Just check it out there. More details. And we've had this discussion over the years, and now it's kind of coming to a head here, and we'll continue to have it. And listen, y'all have questions on either side of this. I think those are fair. Let's figure out what the right move here is. I'll tell you, though, pretty darn protective, the Mobile Tensile Delta. I'm just ingrained. Has got that in me. All right. Secretary of State of the State of Alabama, John Merrill, joins us next right here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you all along. This segment of the show brought to you by 1-800-GOT-JUNK, online at 1-800-GOT-JUNK.com. That's my buddy Trey. He's been doing this for 13 years in Mobile and Baldwin County. And you know the name. You know the vehicles. You see them around town. The 1-800-GOT-JUNK truck. Well, here's how you get them to stop at your house. Just go online to 1-800-GOT-JUNK.com or pick up the phone and call 1-800-GOT-JUNK. And they'll say, hey, what day works? Because they realize you got family, you got work, you got things to do. They'll find out, not that, hey, they'll be there between Monday and Friday, 8 to 5. No, they're going to say, what day works? Okay, Tuesday. How about 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Tuesday? Does that work? Yes. They make an appointment, they show up, and they quote you a price. If you say yes, they get to work and get it done. So it could be junk at your house, your office, house you're getting ready to sell, storage unit you've been paying on all these years. Get rid of the junk and use my buddy Trey with 1-800-GOT-JUNK online at 1-800-GOT-JUNK.com. All right, look up here in the studio. Usually, I am bringing this man's cell phone sometime, you know, real close to the election cycle. Secretary of State John Merrill joining us in studio. Thanks for being here.
Sean, thank you for having me as your guest, brother. It's always good to be with you, but always better in person, in studio.
That's right. And as you canvass the state of Alabama, I've been in the secretary's office doing radio shows maybe 2 years ago or last year, and you have a map there with all the pins from the different places you stop in the state. You don't miss much in the 67 counties.
Try not to, my friend. And we've been very fortunate. Just since January the 1st of this year, we've already been to 28 of the 67 counties.
See what I'm talking about, y'all?
For 75 unique visits already. So excited about that.
When you go there, I mean, is it sometime to be there and just see folks, or is it usually
like
some
today?
Kind of,
yeah. I had a meeting in Atmore, mm-hmm, in Escambia County with a legislator,
okay,
Greg Albritton,
sure,
who's chairman of the general fund,
sure,
as well as economic development professional there that works to make sure that they're doing all they need to do in that county to ensure that they're serving the needs of their people in the infrastructure improvement and rural development for water, sewer, and things like that.
Let's talk about the job of the Secretary of State and just going through what was a at least confusing voting cycle for some people, some states. Alabama seemed to get it better than other states. So, you know,
thank you for that.
Yeah, I mean, it was the mild confusion of one state turned out to be the huge confusion of another state. And then you look at other states that said, no, we got this.
Sure. And, of course, just 2 weeks ago, we were named as the number one state in the union for election integrity for the 2020 cycle. That's never happened in the history of Alabama.
It's the polar opposite of all the states we ended up talking about.
That's
after
right.
The election.
And we're excited about that, to be able to take that level of competency and election security, transparency, and accountability in our election administration to other states. And that's what I'm doing now as the chairman of the National Commission on Election Integrity. So this is a very, very exciting time to be an election official. Who ever thought anybody would say that, my brother?
Well, you've got... If you're doing this nationally, you can fight the fight here in Alabama and show that obviously they saw you get the notice, but you can't. What can you change? What goes on in some other state?
Well, that's a great point. You know, I spoke to all the lieutenant governors just last Thursday, and I was telling them in my presentation, you want to do something to correct your election issues in your state? The first thing that each one of you needs to do is you need to look at the election laws in your state related to your state. And you need to make sure that in every local jurisdiction in your state, they're following the laws that are already on the books. Because, and I use these states as examples. I said, in the 15 counties in Arizona, they're not doing that. In the 16 counties in Nevada, they're not doing that. The 67 counties in Pennsylvania and the 67 counties in California, they're not doing that. In the 46 counties in South Carolina, they're not doing that. And in the 159 counties in Georgia, everybody knows they're not doing that. So you need to make sure your states are following your own laws first before you start trying to pass new laws for election administration.
So how do you do that, though? Let's say there's 158. I mean, before an election, sure. Here's program. Here's our policy. But on election day, I know I've talked to you. You're very busy, but you can't be at every place policing everything.
But, Sean, that's why you have to have trained professionals who know what they're doing. In this instance, the probate judges in our county, the circuit clerks in our counties, the sheriffs in our counties, the registrars in our counties, and all the poll workers that man the 1,980 polling sites. In doing that, it puts us in a position to know that even though something may be going wrong, that at least everybody's been trained and everybody knows what their responsibility is and everybody knows what they should be doing. And that's the key. It's not that somebody that's in Escambia County or somebody that's in Conecuh County or somebody that's in Cleburne County is going to go out and do what they want to on their own. That's the anomaly. And we don't see that in Alabama, but whenever it's introduced to us, we give it attention immediately, such with the situation that we had a few years ago with curbside voting. So whenever that happens, you know to be on top of it.
Right. And talk about that, too, because the challenges of this last election cycle in the general pandemic, absentee, curbside voting, you have to navigate all that. This question that comes back to it, and you talked about it the other day for I don't know if you use the right term, no-fault absentee or no-excuse absentee voting. Can you explain that to me versus what it had been?
Well, absolutely. You know, the bill. One of the things that we do every time we have the administration of an election is we go back and we look at the things that happened, and then we see where we could improve or where we need to make sure that we go forward in what we're doing. This election was no different. So we had four things that we wanted to do. And in addition to that, we had legislators, as they always do, will bring bills on their own about things that are important to them. So my legislative liaison brought this bill for no excuse absentee voting to me and said, Representative Laura Hall from Huntsville is doing this. Is this something that you think we'd be in support of? And I said, no, but it may be something that we can improve. And so let's look at it. So we added the things that we thought were necessary. What are those things? Number one, you recall that we were able to open absentee ballots at 7 a.m. during this election cycle instead of noon. Well, we had to do that through an executive order from the governor, but that needs to be codified. Number two, we had to embrace the fact that some people were not going to be able to get their absentee ballots in on time because the deadline is the application has to be returned no later than 5 days before the election. Then the ballot has to be in no later than noon on election day. So we looked at changing the deadline. Instead of it being 5 days for mail-in, make it 10 days. So pushing it back out so there's enough time to turn them around.
Okay.
And then third, to make sure that there were enough people that were working the polls. So if you needed them, you could add a couple of folks to the process. And last but not least, there's some confusing language related to postmarking of absentee ballots. And it says that as long as they're postmarked by a certain day, as long as they're received by a certain day, they'll be counted. Well, really none of that matters. The only thing that matters is whether or not it's received by a certain day.
Right, and that's, oh my gosh, that brings up a, you know, a whole side question, but people can go look at the Twitter feed. I put up pictures late last week. We checked the mailbox here at the radio station.
Yes, sir.
And we had mail from as early as September on through. I mean, publications like I got a copy of the Call News newspaper from November, had stuff from Blue Cross Blue Shield from September 3rd and 4th, had invoices. People, I'm just telling y'all our business. I mean, people we that are customers of ours, and we said, hey, you, check coming? Sent the check a month ago. Their checks were just, I had a whole, I mean, this really just happened here.
Right.
So that's my worry about this is, like, how do you
and
back
see,
it up far
thing,
enough?
Like with the postmarks, for example.
Yeah, but if you get that now, okay, I got it. Say there was a ballot in there and I got it now.
That's right. It's not counting.
It's March 1st.
Exactly. And it's not counting. And that's what I told somebody is the reason we don't need the postmark there is because I'm surprised somebody didn't file a lawsuit last time about that issue.
Mm-hmm.
But if they had mailed their absentee ballot back to us on September the 15th and it was received on November the 4th, it's still not counting. nor should it, because it didn't arrive by the deadline. Now, we already passed legislation to enable people to be able to return their ballots in a way other than using the Postal Service. They use FedEx, UPS, DHL, whatever it is that they choose. But that's their option. But when we looked at the no-excuse absentee ballot provision, the eliminating
which it used to be, kind of give me, like the used to be you had to, but doctor appointment or
you're sick,
out of town, out of the country.
Yeah, ill or infirmed, I'm out of county on election day, I'm having to work a double shift. There's 10 different things.
Okay.
I'm so away in school, I'm incarcerated, all these different things. And so we said, well, that can be a vehicle that we can ride. But I can tell you that it became very clear to us that that's not a debate that the Alabama legislature wants to have. And so my recommendation is to Laura Hall, who is the person that's carrying that bill, and it was laid on the table last week when it was up for debate, is that she just not continue to advance that legislation. That's not productive for the state. It's not going to be productive for her. We're going to get a separate vehicle, a new bill that we're going to bring and talk about the things that I said that we added to that bill so that those things can be put in place with another vehicle if the body thinks that it's meritorious of consideration.
So as we look at that, it's going to be not as laid out by Representative Hall, but it is some adjustment or some growth in that.
Yes, because we're not for no excuse absentee voting, and we're not going to let that be the vehicle that's a part of this, because that discussion is not going to be productive.
You know, I wonder with this and getting noticed nationally for what we've done here on elections, is there a time that what, and I don't know who judges for that whole group, would want something for us that we wouldn't as Alabamians think is
No, because one of the things that we're doing with the commission is we are putting together best practice legislation. So my vision for the team that's made up of five secretaries and 22 legislators from around the nation is that we have a product, a piece of legislation that was passed, statutory language, that you say, okay, I'm from Louisiana, and I think we need to have early in-person voting in Louisiana. So my question would be, if I'm from Louisiana and I'm asking that question, what states do it right and well?
Right.
And so we want to have that language so you can adopt that language as is, or you can choose to modify the existing statutory language we're providing for you to consider.
Right, and you put some Cajun accent on it in that case, but I mean, but I mean, and I don't say this in a negative way, but a bit of a boilerplate that these are best practices. This works if you want to adopt it.
That have already been
tested.
Yes, sir. Yeah. Just like ours is the gold standard for voter ID, and I was challenged by one of my friends who is on the commission, who's the secretary from Tennessee. He said, "Well, John, you used Alabama as the standard for voter ID." He said, "We have a strong voter ID law." I said, "Yeah, but it's not as good as ours."
There you go.
And he said, "Well, why do you say that?" I said, "Because we went to the Supreme Court twice last year, not the Alabama Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court, and it was upheld." I said, "Our voter ID law is the gold standard because our law is the only law in the nation that's the same today as it was when Robert Bentley signed it after we passed it in 2011.
No adjustments to
it. No, sir. None.
Just a minute and a half left here, but let's talk about this going forward. Do you have faith that we get this corrected in the states, the other states, the next cycle? Because I got people who say they're never going to vote again. Secretary, they say, "I'm never voting. I don't believe what happens. I'm never voting again."
But you know, the main thing got to do, Sean, is we have to instill confidence in the voter. The voter has got to know that when they cast their ballot, it's going to count for the candidate of their choice. And if they
there's people who talk to me all the time that don't feel that that's true.
That's right. And so we have to show them how, of course, people believe in Alabama that is true, but they're worried about these other states.
Other states, exactly.
And so we want them to adopt our mantra and to say that we're going to make it easy to vote and hard to cheat. And if you're doing that in your state, people will regain confidence in the process and then they'll participate.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you,
brother. Stopping by. We'll get to talk again soon.
Yes, sir.
All right. There he is, Secretary of State of the state of Alabama, and the man who's 28 counties in already at this point. He's coming to a county near you soon. That's Secretary of State John Merrill. Coming right back to wrap it up here on Midday Mobile.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, this is Dan Brennan on FM Talk 106.5. It's time for a checkup, and our guest today from Alabama Orthopedic Clinic is Dr. Matthew Barber. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's good to have a guy in here that what you do, you wake up every day, and you look at your day, and it's generally helping people restore their quality of life in many cases. Talk about the patients that you see, and I know that your specialty is joint replacement surgery, knee and hip.
Correct. We are absolutely quality of life doctors. That's mm-hmm. what orthopedic surgery is primarily about. So with what I do with joint replacement of the knee and hip, it's very much about restoring mobility for patients that have either old injuries or arthritis. And we're really about letting them be active again and restoring their mobility and their quality of life.
Have you ever had a patient that was so far down the road in terms of his own pain or her own pain, they didn't think it was really... there was a procedure that was possible, but would they actually be able to feel that much better?
Yeah, there's always options, and that's what we really do is try to individualize treatment for each patient. So for everybody, no matter where they are in terms of their injury or illness, there's mm-hmm. virtually always some type of option for them, and then we just try to select the best one.
I know that your practice uses the best technology. Talk about that changing technology and the improvements you've seen, of course, it lead to better results.
Yeah, so joint replacement has overwhelmingly been successful. These are procedures that have been around a long time in the U.S. and around the world. And overall, they're very successful. They're very durable. They do help restore patients' quality of life. What technology has done has enabled us, it's enabled us to get better and better at those. So it's improved the accuracy of what we do mm-hmm. With technologies like computer navigation and robotics and custom implant surgery that's based on 3D printing technology. We're able to be extremely precise so that we're really addressing things in a very individualized manner for each patient. And those things help us to be more accurate so that we have a higher percentage of patients who have really great results. And the ones that do have really durable results.
And durable is important because we're talking about it needs to last a long time. What you end up doing in that operating room has got to sustain itself for years and years.
Absolutely. We still have a lot of folks that operate under the illusion or the myth that a joint replacement surgery may only last 10 years. We've got incredible amounts of data now that a hip replacement or a knee replacement is overwhelmingly likely to last 20 years, 25 years or more. So a lot of patients put off seeking out some of those solutions because they are worried that it may not be durable when, in fact, on a statistical basis, they're overwhelmingly likely not just to do well, but to do well for a long time.
Speaking of doing well, how about this? The fact that your patients don't necessarily have to stay even one night in the hospital. Some of this is outpatient in your outpatient surgery center. Talk about that, how you can quickly get home and begin that recovery process in the comfort and safety of your own home. That's where you want to be, right?
This is really exciting to us and has been part of a trend nationally over the last few years that has really come home here locally very recently. So we've always done a lot of surgeries in our outpatient surgery center, but because of some of the newer technologies, because of advanced pain control protocols, because of surgical techniques, we're now able to do complete knee replacements and hip replacements on an outpatient basis. So patients are able to go home sometimes the same day of surgery, even if they're in the hospital. And a lot of those can be done in our outpatient surgery center. And as you said, they're able to recover in the comfort of their own home and the relative safety of their own home.
Time for a checkup with Dr. Matthew Barber from AOC. He's a fellowship trained specialist in joint replacement surgery of the knee and the hip. I guess there are advantages. When you talk about some of these techniques, technologies, how much of an advantage are things like the robotics and the computer navigation. What have you seen as a surgeon that lets you know this is the right thing to do?
Well, I think we're waiting on a lot of real long-term data on some of these technologies, but I think intuitively, even for somebody like myself, I do hundreds of joint replacements a year. I'm theoretically as well positioned as anybody to do well with those surgeries mm-hmm. and to evaluate what helps. So I want things in my tool bag, if you will, to make me more accurate, to try to make me better. We're always pushing to get better and better and better with what we do.
And I guess there's got to be, aside from the professional satisfaction, and I know that you're a specialist. There are those who seek you out from regionally, for sure, because of what you do and the standard that you hold yourself to. But there's got to be also just a level of on the human side, seeing somebody relieved of so much pain and begin their journey on this next part of their life relatively pain-free and with a whole lot more mobility. I mean, that's got to feel good.
I've got the greatest job in the world, hands down, and seeing those recoveries is amazing. And I've got sports medicine partners that it's a huge kick for them to help somebody or fix somebody that can go back to athletics. For me, it's more likely somebody that's upper middle age mm-hmm. that gets to walk through Disney World with their grandkids or just go back to doing stuff that they want to do every day. That's a huge, huge high for me.
Dr. Barber, you're a fellowship trained specialist. It sounds impressive, but a lot of us might, you know what I'm saying? It sounds good to Mr. Dan. Hey, that's great. What exactly does it mean? And what does that mean to the patients?
Okay. So all orthopedic surgeons after medical school undergo residency training in orthopedics, and that's 5 years. And it covers really every sub-discipline in orthopedics, from trauma care, foot and ankle surgery, hand surgery, sports medicine, spine, all the different aspects of orthopedic surgery. And at this point, probably most, certainly a lot of graduates from residency, rather than going straight into practice and doing general orthopedics, where they do a little bit of everything, do specialize. And so that's where you spend an additional year in fellowship training. And so for me, I spent an additional year doing nothing but knee and hip replacement surgery and being trained in that. And so that's an extra level of expertise, if you will, that you carry into practice. And then certainly you build on that over time, just with repetition and with doing a lot of surgeries. And because my practice is exclusively limited to those things, mm-hmm. I do them over and over. And we do have published data, published research that tells us that surgeons and institutions that do these types of surgeries in higher volumes do have better outcomes and lower complication rates. And that's what we're after.
Seems to be all kinds of very highly decorated specialists at AOC. So your colleagues all around you are excellent at what they do as well.
Absolutely. I've got great partners that do all those different aspects of orthopedics that we touched on. And it's definitely become very specialized. And I think patients understand that and appreciate it, that, hey, I want to see somebody that takes care of this problem all the time.
Dr. Barber, thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Matthew Barber, on time for a checkup for AOC, Alabama Orthopedic Clinic.